How is that, Irene?
Sorry.
Have you heard anything from the city yet about when things will start returning back to in person?
There are several work groups that are working on that with different bureaus and divisions and then across the city. So they're in the planning and research stages, but we don't know anything at the moment. Kind of operating under, like, for sure until July and possibly until September, so don't know exactly.
Yeah,
And some
that's
people, like some folks are just, if they're all vaccinated, they're going back to the office. But the public still has specific, there are specific rules around public coming in, so.
okay. Well, hopefully soon it looks like everything is kind of quieting down and our vaccination rates are pretty good.
That's true.
Yeah.
I've heard from Reed College. They've been on lockdown since August. Nobody there unless you have a reason to be there, and they're planning on opening up in July.
We've had some emails in my line of work as well about opening up soon. So the U.S. government's kind of looking into that, and each agency I think is going to have their own plan. But I think some things are opening up in July, and then probably by September is what I'm hearing as well. Maybe sooner. I think there's a lot of pressure on people being in person. So hopefully.
I have some contacts with the Latino community, and they're working really hard on getting their vaccination rates up with some success.
I wish we could say the same for the Slavic Russian-speaking community because it's not going very well.
Yeah, don't get me started on that, Irene.
I've been working on that for a year now, and it's so discouraging.
It's almost a point of pride in a way, which is, one thing. But I had something videotaped a while back, and absolutely no precautions at all. Just, come in, let's videotape it. No social distancing. And I'm like, I think you should look into that a little bit, or at least get vaccinated if you're going to be doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, let's get started. I think we have a few people here. And since this is just kind of a planning framework at this point in time, I'm sure as things get formulated and we have a plan of action, we'll start inviting more community members to provide feedback and get information about the things that we're doing. So Jim, I was hoping Shayna would be here because I think she's kind of taking the lead with this, along with Candace. I think from direction from Candace about some of the work that you've been working on with the with reviewing the IPR and CRC protocols and seeing what how that would translate over to the new board. And so if you don't mind, could you be in the spotlight here for a little bit and talk about what you've looked into? Hi,
Okay,
Barbara.
I wrote a document which I sent to the policy committee, at least the names that Irene got me. Is there anybody here who doesn't have it and I can try and put it into the chat box?
I think everybody on the committee has it.
I don't know if Dan has it.
Dan does not, and Barb here, who just arrived, would not.
Okay, I am going to put it into the chat box. It's a document, it's a Word document called Clio. And I hope here it comes. Oh Lord, too many things on the screen. Here we go. Does that work? Come on. No. I got you. Well, let's try it this way. No, that doesn't work either. Do you have it? Can you park it in there for me?
You're asking me to drop it in?
I'm asking you if you could. Oh, I think I just succeeded. Let's find out. Nope.
Okay, let
Yeah,
me see if I can find it.
can you park Cleo into the chat?
I would, but I don't know how to add documents into the chat, or at least I don't have that function. So maybe Irene is able to do that.
CLEO stands for Community Law Enforcement Oversight, in case you're interested. And I have a snarky footnote that it's in honor of Geppetto's pet goldfish from the Walt Disney Pinocchio, which mostly shows how old I am. We have it. There's a little file button. Okay, I see it. And my options are Dropbox, Microsoft OneDrive, Google Drive Box, and Microsoft SharePoint. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not going in the way you would expect a document to go in.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that. Okay, so
Dan, what if we emailed it to you?
Candace, do you have it?
Yeah, for some reason I'm not getting the file thing at all. All I can do is just save.
Okay, I can do this. I'm going to send it to Candace and Dan. I have their emails.
All right, I'm going to forward it to Dan.
You already forwarded it to Dan?
I'm doing that now.
Okay, and forward it to Candace for me then, please.
Okay.
Okay, basically what happened is last meeting of this, we were talking about modifying, taking a look at how this group could get a head start on helping the Rethink Police Accountability Group get started. And I promised to look at in detail at how the city auditor looked at stuff with number 5.18, which is policy. And I looked at that and I decided that was the wrong question. So I looked looked in more depth at everything on 5.18. There are 24 separate measures, numbered 1 through 18 and 20 through 25. There is no 19. And I separated them out into what is the function of this thing, who are the structures that they address, and what are the processes that they do. The structure and processes comes from my health research experience that a guy named Avidas Donabedian, who looked at things in terms of outcomes, functions, and processes. And outcomes is measurement, and I didn't want to deal with measurement right now, but I tried to deal with function and structure and process, and I decided that for this group, we had to look at function as well. So I looked at all 24 of the Citizen Review Committee administrative rules and separated them out into what are the functions of these rules, who are the structures that are involved, and what are the processes. And I hope this would provide a trigger for discussion from people who had looked at it and would see it and would say, hey, that looks interesting, or I wish it had been slightly different. And whatever. So it was not my intention to talk about this, but rather to get into a conversation about it. So that's where I was. And I can flip on the fly if you want me to, Vadim, it's your call.
Up to you, you have the floor.
What?
Did you say you wanted to discuss
it? I just want to see if how people reacted to it. But if you want me to walk through all 24 of them and get them one at a time, I can do that as well. And some of them will be involved. Some of them won't take any time at all. And some of them may take a lot of time.
If you could still hold on to the floor and talk about it a little bit. I'm getting the access requests for the documents, so I'm kind of multitasking.
Okay. I looked at the chat, and I think there's a link that you put in. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So the first
can I interrupt and ask a quick question?
Sure.
I just wanted to ask quickly, before you go into this, Ross made the comment last night that the auditor's office doesn't have to have an IPR. And I just wondered, within city code, we have to have an IPR, right? But it doesn't necessarily have to live in the auditor's office. What was trying to be said? I was confused by that.
Not having been there and not being a lawyer, I abstain on that. So somebody else please take that.
No, that's my understanding as well. There needs to be an IPR, and that's part of the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be within the auditor's office. I can't give you the exact history of that. I suppose taking it outside of the mayor's office and the police chief and that kind of thing would be important. But beyond that, I assume that's what he meant, but I don't know.
So the point was that part isn't like embedded in code. It just happens to be that's where it exists at the current time.
Actually, it says in city code, the auditor is independent police review. So yeah, city code would have to be, the auditor doesn't want to do it anymore. I'm not quite sure what there is to gain by trying to shuffle around this agency in the last years. I mean,
well, so what did Ross mean by it doesn't have? I mean, to me, I mean, obviously,
well, I think what he meant,
but
the auditor is very adamant that the ballot measure that passed a few years ago that says she gets to decide what she wants to work on means that city council can't tell her what to do. Mm-hmm. But it also seems to jettison something that's been a part of the office for 20 years, based on, you know, the ballot measure that came up 17 years into that.
Okay. All right. I'm still going to be a little confused on that, but I think that's okay. Thanks. I appreciate that, Dan.
Okay, Jim. So can you just briefly summarize, I guess, what you're seeing and what do you think the next steps should be for us?
Okay. I'm saying that since my interpretation of the conversation a month ago was that this particular subcommittee might want to, as soon as there is a group that's going to try and find a structure for the rethinking police to how to do it. And that was a month ago, and there's been no progress since then. So God only knows when it'll happen. If this particular group wants to get in touch with them and have a position, a good way to think about it would be, what is it that you want to accomplish, which is the heading I have. Where do we want to be, and how will we know how close we've come? I'm going to address with how will we know how close we come later, not in this document, but where do we want to be? How do we want to influence? What are the vision we have for what police reform would be? And people were talking about the CRC, because this is a CRC subcommittee, and reference was made to the administrative rules that govern the CRC. And we said, this is a good place, and the IPR, as it turns out, and this is a good place to start by considering how much of these need to be carried over, how much of these can be changed, and how much of these do we want to look at something completely different? And is there anything that's not here that we think should be there? So if we look at these, this is a way of thinking in those terms. And so the starting point are the 24 administrative rules that the many auditors ago came in. It's been modified occasionally, but this thing is basically 20 years old. And has it served the test of time? Have we seen flaws? Have we seen weaknesses? How much of this is stuff that will need to be carried over into whatever police external oversight board will appear in Portland, allegedly within the next 2 years, but God only knows if it'll happen, especially not within that time frame. And so I came up with looking in detail at the 24 administrative rules. And that was the essence of my document.
And so would the next step be for us to maybe get together, whether at another meeting or in maybe a smaller subcommittee to actually discuss these rules and talk about the pros and cons and what we're seeing and if there's a way to, whether they're worth keeping or improving, that sort of thing?
In terms of another committee or a smaller group, my answer is no, this is a pretty small group. And I think this would be an efficient way to do it if we choose to do it now. I'm missing Shana. If we want to say, well, geez, Shana might be an essential person on this, so we might want to defer it until she can make it. That might make sense to me.
Okay.
But I'm willing to defer it, or I'm willing to go forward now, and that's your call, buddy.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of things to cover in this meeting, so I think we can't get into the meat of the discussion at this point in time. And likewise, I think Shana's taking the lead on this, so I want her to kind of know what's going on and also have input on these things. But at least now I get a better sense of what the next steps will be. So going through these 24 rules, discussing what we're seeing, what's working, and I think we'll need IPR assistance on this as well. From I think some of these rules we don't deal with day to day, and so get a sense of what IPR is seeing on their end, whether things are working and not working with those as well. What do y'all think about that?
Okay, the one thing I will add to that is if you want to look at who the actors are, and if you want all the actors present, the subcommittee might want to have a special session in which there's IPR representation. Well, we have IPR representation. Irene's here. Nobody's been there longer than she has, to my knowledge. You might want to have somebody from the IAD speak. Certainly that happened when the CRC introductory information happened. They had a heavy role, and maybe or maybe not from the police commissioner's office, I don't care. But these are the main actors in the structures that were in this document. So if you want to have an extended conversation, might be a good idea to have all of the people who have a role in these structures there to talk about their perspective, because this is very much a view of the elephant kind of situation.
Okay. Thanks. Julie, Candace, would you have any input on those discussions so far? Start open the floor. Okay. How about the public, Mr. Handelman, Barb, would you have any input on how to go about tackling some of these rules with respect to making recommendations to the next board about things worth keeping and things that can be improved upon?
Well, I definitely have some ideas. I mean, I think one of the first things that should be done is take this document that Jim has put together, Mr. Khan, and he is a CRC.
Jim is fine, Dad.
Anyway, but the to overlay this with the ballot measure and see what will translate over and what won't and what has to be thought about. So. For instance, we don't know whether the new oversight board is going to conduct hearings on the most basic complaints and then also hear appeals, or if they're going to split into different bodies to hear appeals, or if they're going to take on the functions of the police review board. There's a lot of things that are up in the air, but looking at what's actually written on the page could help advise which of these protocols can be helpful for the new board. I particularly, of course, I'm interested in, where is it? Oh, there's one about public input. And I just want to, public comment period, 5.07. I just want to make it clear that there was a short period of time when there was a discussion about the structure of IPR and CRC where they were trying to eliminate public comment before votes at appeal hearings. And I think particularly last night was a good example of why it's important to have those. and that got ended up getting written into city code. So it's now a part of the system. It's codified in the system. So I think that's one of the things I'd like to see CRC weigh in, because one of the reasons it got codified is the CRC members at the time encouraged city council to make sure this, the community got heard from. So I don't want that to get lost in this discussion. Thank you.
I think that's a great idea, Dan. We have to keep in mind that the people we'll be talking to first will not be making this codification, but will instead be providing advice for what this group will eventually do. Well, maybe they will be doing that. Okay, I retract what I said. I think you just simply have a good point, and I'll leave it at that. You're muted, Vadim.
Thank you. So Shana said she was going to watch this video, and I'll cycle back with her and see how she wants to proceed about this. I think this is going to take a few of our meetings probably in order to go through these rules and discuss them and bring in relevant expertise in order to figure out what's working and what's not. But we'll have a framework for that. Okay, so yes, Julia, you're on mute.
Yeah, I have sort of a dumb question. So all of these like 5.01, 5.02, I see what you've done, Jim, but is there text under all of these things that explain, like, where is the text that, where's the corresponding text that you're drawing from?
I footnote the document. Click on that.
Okay. Wait. All right. I see. And then I just want to make sure I understand when I go through this.
Okay. What has happened is that each of the 19 is separately accessible, but I gave you the footnote for 01, and from there you can click on all of them and get it. That's an adequate
way to
find every one of them.
Okay, and then there are individual PDFs if you click
correct.
On.
If you click down the road, and again, it's 1 through 18 and 20 through 25.
Right. Okay. So you've taken this. Okay, I understand now. Thank you very, very much.
It wasn't easy to come up with that, so I hope I saved you some time.
I mean, my goodness, there's a lot here. So, I mean, I think that we need to prioritize which areas are the most important to us, because I think even choosing five and kind of going through the process that Jim, you outlined would be, and really reviewing what's currently in place, figuring out what actually is, how that differs from how things work in practice, and making recommendations about how they should work, is going to be a heavy lift. I think it's a great idea, but I just think that we're really going to need to prioritize.
I'm total agreement with that. I just put them in numerical order because that was the easiest way to do it. I don't want to be the person who prioritizes. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, but that could be our next thing that we do as a group, is to figure out which ones are the most important.
Well, I'm sure that some of them are burning issues for some people, like number 7 is for Dan. So whoever feels most strongly can say, let's look at this, and then we can do it.
Okay. I'm going to move to my phone. So whoever's the host, I'm going to go off and come back on. So I'll be waiting in the waiting room again. If you could just keep your eye on that. I'm just going to.
You bet, Julie. I'll watch for you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
So I'll hold off for a sec on discussing the next topic, which is the body camera research, until Julie comes back here. But I do want to put up, she won't receive it if I put something in the chat, but here we go. This is a recent study that has been performed on body-worn cameras. So in the past, there have been studies in certain jurisdictions such as Washington, D.C., that have found negligible effects on body-worn cameras, or at least nothing that would stand out above and beyond perhaps statistical differences in the studies. And this study that came out recently, I believe it was in May, is the largest study that has been done to date. So it's reviewed not only the previous studies that have been done, but also two more recent studies within New York City, as well as a second study that reviewed data from 2,000 police departments nationwide to get a more granular look at the effects of having body-worn cameras on the police bureau. So that the second study, which I just referenced, showed that complaints against the police bureau decreased about 17%. And we're also, and there's also a 9.6% reduction in the use of force by the police that is directly attributable to the body-worn cameras. This was a double-blind study, supposedly. So it's, as far as I can tell, not being a statistician, something that is was a scientific study, and once again, the biggest study about this to date. So it seems that this might have a positive effect on both complaints against the police bureau and affect how the police are treating individuals, and whatever extent you want to interpret that, but also more than that, use of force against individuals, which I think is even a reduction in the use of force by 9.6% statistically, I think is substantial. So having seen this larger study, I wanted to kind of bring it up for discussion. I know I'm just dropping this on y'all, so please use that link and review it at leisure, something that I think is in the future would be worth looking into. As you all know, the police bureau a couple of years ago received some funding for creating a policy and a pilot project on body-worn cameras. And we had a discussion here within the CRC on what that policy might look like. PSEP provided the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing provided an outline as to if a policy was developed, what are some of the aspects that they would like to see in that policy. So Julie, not sure back online, I know it's your phone, but I put in the message document here about a study on body-worn cameras. And then the project was stopped. I think the money was shifted around and it never took off. The besides the decrease in both use of force as well as complaints against police as a result of body-worn cameras, another aspect of this study is the cost savings of body-worn cameras. It appears that there's a $5 to $1 cost savings to a city in implementing it. Getting the body cameras, as my understanding, is not very expensive. It's the storage, retrieval, people to review it, and provide those that footage to whomever needs to review it seems to be where the majority of the cost is. Even with a police force like Portland with 900 or so police members, you can imagine that storing all that video would be expensive. And so if there is a cost savings, whether it's due to having people like internal affairs or otherwise review things, or cost savings to police oversight and having like investigations by the DA into what actually occurred, and if the police use too much force and things like that, if some of those answers could be better resolved with the use of body cameras and having a cost savings in that sort of way, it might affect the calculus there. So to Mr. Handelman's question there, the abstract here talks about how they carried out a cost-benefit analysis of body-worn cameras, as financial barriers are often cited as key impediments. The baseline estimate for benefit cost ratio is 4.95. So, and it seems like that in their view that the body worn cameras might pay for themselves. That, you know, I'm sure there's arguments on both sides, but it is millions of dollars over the years it costs, millions of dollars per year it costs to store that data. So nonetheless, this is something that I think the figure that's always handed out is out of the 75 biggest cities in the United States, Portland is the only one that does not have body-worn cameras. Portland seems to be the only main police organization in the region around here that does not have body-worn cameras. And so, you know, are we the only ones doing it right, or is there a way to improve that? And the two factors in my mind are, of course, like, what is the benefit to the public? You know, what is the benefit to organizations that oversee the police? And what is the benefit to, you know, the budget hit or benefit from that? And even if there's a budget hit, if there's a large benefit to the community, I still think that's a selling point. But according to the study, at least that might not be as big of a budget hit as initially imagined. And, you know, we had a CRC hearing last night where we were talking about videos only capturing a portion of the actual event that occurred. And, you know, had there been body-worn cameras, I would posit that we would have had more of a picture as to what happened and whether the allegations made by the appellant were correct or not, because the video that was captured from the helicopter showed the last part of the police interaction, or it might have been the majority, but not the initial part. And so whether there was veracity in the reporting, whether the police used excessive force, whether the individual was perhaps, you know, not actually, whether there's not probable cause against the individual, those are all the things that sort of happened before the cameras came in and showed what the after effects were. There were some pictures, but still the videos were limited. So in my mind, there seems to be some benefit in having the broader view of what's going on in order to ascertain the full arc of the interactions with the police bureau, rather than relying on people's cameras or the news cameras or otherwise. Yes, Ms. Jim Woe.
Okay, a couple of interesting things about that. The study, I've seen some, but not all the studies you've looked at. And I'm reasonably well convinced that body cameras are a good idea for a number of reasons. One is that they're supposed to happen, and it would be part of police policy and directives that they be on. And if it turns out that at any time that for any substantial proportion of claims that the CRC would review, they're not on, that's a story in and of itself that is highly impactful in what's going on here. So just that, all by itself, says something. Anybody who says that it costs a lot to store data doesn't know what they're talking about. I'll just be brutal. Data storage is cheap. And the issue is finding it. And if it's a recent event, finding it is less hard. And the telling point you just made is we're the biggest, Portland has the biggest police force in the country without it. Either everybody else is doing something wrong, or we're doing something right, and the odds are 74-1 against us if you just take a random sample.
And to your point, Jim, I agree. It's about making sure that those cameras are on, having good policies behind that, and ensuring that those policies are followed. So I asked people, you know, what is a city that if there were good policies out there is doing it right? And the city that I was most pointed to or referred to was New Orleans. They also have a consent decree with the Justice Department and have body cameras. And they actually have an independent individual, an office, I guess, but an independent individual that oversees that, who's kind of like the ombudsman for the body camera videos. And they interviewed her about some of the stuff. And she mentioned directly the things that you've mentioned, which is, you know, people did not initially have uniformity in the way that they followed those policies. Sometimes police officers would not turn them on. There was some confusion. Perhaps there were people not doing it. And she pointed out to, you know, in the past that, you know, people might have been able to like plant things on individuals, and body cameras when they were turned off would allow for something like that, but maybe not so much when they were turned on. So, but the crux of that matter is that policies were developed in New Orleans and they started taking disciplinary actions against police officers that were not turning on their video cameras. And when the police officers realized that that was happening, all of a sudden the video cameras uniformly started to be turned on, or the body cameras uniformly started to be turned on when there were interactions. Now, there are some caveats to that about protecting individuals who might be in certain situations where you would not want them to be videotaped, or they would not want to be videotaped and all things. And those are policy decisions. But she did address that issue.
It's interesting that New Orleans comes up here, because New Orleans is the source of something else that we're about to institute here. It's already state law, and that's the active bystandership law for law enforcement. In other words, cops, if they see something that's illegal or out of policy being done by other cops, have a responsibility to intervene. And that goes hand in hand with the video cams. If you're wearing a video cam and you see a fellow officer doing something that's wrong, you're going to capture it. And I think it's no accident that the ABLE program, which Georgetown University developed, was based upon work done in New Orleans, because they are a leader in this regard. But that just strengthens the need for the body cams.
And that's, once again, that's what I view it. I think Mr. Handelman will have some input here in a second. He's already posted some in the chat. And, you know, we've discussed this a little bit in previous meetings about the outward facing aspect of the body cameras, that they're not actually reflecting what the officers are doing rather than what the people in front of them are doing. You know, to that, I would say also that if there's several officers in the same vicinity, they do capture each other. But I think individually that's a challenge. But also it's hard to, from my perspective, and some of these complaints we have against the police bureau, so often they come down to he says, she says, they say, they said, so on and so forth. And we keep going back and asking for more video footage. One time we had an individual that drove into the parking lot, parking structure of the sheriff's office, and was arrested for that, and claimed that there was retaliation against him and physical abuse as part of that. And we were trying to like reach out and get the actual parking videos from that structure, which apparently are not kept for that long. And then from a different branch from the sheriff's office, so getting it from the city, getting it from the county became an impediment. And so many of these things seem like they could be rectified if there were body cameras that were working and recording it, or at least not maybe rectified, but giving us a better idea of what was going on in order to, you know, weigh the different conflicts in the testimony. Because what so often happens is you have, you know, 10 police officers saying nothing at all untoward happened, and then one individual saying that, yes, something did happen, abuse or so on and so forth. And the, you know, knee-jerk reflection is going with, you know, the number of people that are saying one thing versus the individual. And that's another aspect where body cameras might help, rather than voices being drowned out by, you know, a larger group of individuals, you actually get, you know, perhaps something that reinforces the one individual that's claiming the experience and seeing it from their end. So, okay. Anyways, I've spoken enough about that. I think I'd like to open it up to anybody else, Julie or Candace, any thoughts on that? Yes.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, Julie, I can now.
I mean, I think this is an interesting process to pursue, but, and I'm sorry, my phone was like not working at all for a little bit, or it was gurgly, but kind of, did you talk about the history, and don't repeat it if you did, I'll figure it out myself, but did you talk about the history of why this, we don't have this in Portland? I mean, I know that that there's been some city council members who have been opposed to it, but I'm not really sure why. Did you talk about that?
I did briefly. If you remember, we had an officer visit us and discuss the policies, and we provide some feedback, and there was supposed to be a pilot project. And then because of objections from, my understanding, one person on city council, but they decided to scrap the project and divert that money toward other things. There was no rationale. I shouldn't say there was no rationale. There was some discussion about the pros and cons of body cameras. And I think many of the points were similar to what Mr. Handelman has been saying, you know, the outward facing for part of body cameras, the cost of body cameras, and also the reliance on police to make sure that they're on, and the trust aspect of that. But there was no, in my recollection at least, there was no vote taken by city council or otherwise as to the reasons behind it or what to do with that money. The project just kind of stopped.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm familiar with the arguments about how, you know, they don't solve everything, but so I, but I guess we're saying here it's been about money and just wanting to put and be people having different priorities around those resources. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. At that point in time, I think it was just a couple $1 million or something like that, that they were going to test pilot it with. And then if it's rolled out, it's more. I understand that now the body cameras themselves, there's been an offer from, I believe, the state to provide the body cameras. That would be a no cost, but the impediment still continues to be the storage and retrieval and individuals to actually review them. And that's what the person in New Orleans said as well, is that it takes a lot of time for people to review these things. So whenever, like, let's say the DA's office needs to ascertain whether to file charges against a police officer, they have to have somebody review those body-worn cameras, and that takes time because some of these videos, you know, go on for quite a while. And so that's part of the city county cost aspect of it.
Are there examples of cities or police departments that have had them and then ceased using them?
That's a good question. I've not to my knowledge, but I'm sure there must be some out there. In fact, I take it back. I think there was one city that wanted to do it. And this was a small town. It was not like a metropolitan area like Portland is, but they got hit with something like millions of dollars a year in operational costs, and they decided not to enact it. But once again, you know, 74 other major cities are able to keep it going with some sort of budget means. So it's possible.
Mr. Mazursky, I would like to say something now, if that's okay.
Of course, Mr. Handelman.
Oh, you know, the thing I posted in the excerpt from the article from the Christian Science Monitor from 2 years ago says that 92% of district attorneys use body cam footage to prosecute civilians, and only 8% use footage to prosecute police officers. And I think that's one of the big concerns of people who don't want the body cameras, that it's not to hold police accountable, it's to hold community members in jails that are already overflowing with community members, and mostly community members of color. And the George Floyd incident was not swung on the body cameras of the officers, it was swung on third-party cop watchers that were recording what happened. So I think, you know, this study, I just did a quick word search for the word prosecute and prosecution, and I don't think they even deal with that question of how often these cameras are used for prosecuting community versus officers, because I couldn't find the word in the document anywhere. So I really think that the costs and benefits in terms of money and psychology are one thing, but what it's going to do to community members' lives, because they don't necessarily know their rights, and officers are going to trick them into confessing to things or doing things, and then putting them in jail for really minor stuff, is much higher than what we're going to benefit from. The only thing that I scrolled through the document a little bit to see where they're saying the cost savings are coming from. They're saying it's coming from not having to pay out in lawsuits. But our data that we've collected for many years now, for almost 30 years now, show that the average amount that Portland pays out in lawsuits is $600,000 a year. And that is far less than what they're saying it's going to cost to run this program. Not to mention that several of these cases will probably still be settled or decided by a jury, even if we get the body camera. So I don't buy this argument. I don't know who did this study, but I find it very lacking.
And so I understand that, Mr. Handelman, and I completely understand your arguments there. So let me at least play devil's advocate here. The payout of the lawsuit is only one aspect of how much it costs the city to actually address the lawsuits. You have the legal costs, you have the use of time on behalf of both the police bureau, the city attorneys, and others in order to adjudicate that stuff and bring it up even to the settlement, and all the other things involved. So there's certainly additional costs that play into that. But also with respect to the prosecutorial aspect of that, I feel comfortable that if a body camera captures somebody, shooting somebody or whatever, that should be used by district attorneys. I don't know if I understand the argument of somebody being caught in the act of committing a crime, that somehow they should go free because there was not a body camera there. Unless all these district attorneys are somehow using it to convict innocent people, I'm not sure I understand the argument that body cameras cause people to go to jail that would otherwise not go to jail. If, as you say, that the police are corrupt and they're tricking people into confessing or otherwise, I would think that's exactly what we need the body cameras for, because it would keep people from being able to connive their way into searching a car, or connive their way into getting a confession, or connive their way into planting evidence, because that's been my number one question. All of a sudden police have a bag of cocaine that was found in a car, but the body camera was not on. Why not? What happened? Why did you turn that off? Those sort of things. So that would be my devil's advocate with respect to that. I think it's having a video is as close to the truth as we can get in some of these things. And the truth cuts both ways. If there are 8% of district attorneys that are prosecuting police officers based on body cameras, that's still better than zero. Now, 92% of people that use body cameras, if body cameras are always on, that's going to be a piece of evidence in a trial, no matter what. So I don't know if that's helping or hurting or exculpatory evidence or anything like that. But if 100% of all interactions are being recorded, there's going to be a lot of them that are going to be used in trials. But still, I'd say 8% of prosecutors using it against the police bureau is higher than I would have even thought. So what do you have to say about that, Mr. Handelman? Any counter thoughts to my counter thoughts?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that people are quote unquote innocent. I'm saying that the laws are set up. What we learned in the last year, if not in the years before that, is that the laws were set up to make more people guilty of crimes because of the way the laws are written. And the more that you're out on the street and recording what people are doing, the more you're going to find people committing those kinds of crimes. You're going to be finding more. I'm using this as a very broad thing because you don't go to jail for this, but you find more people jaywalking if you have your camera running all the time. And you give out more citations for that, even though people do it all the time. But, the police officers will then have this extra information to prosecute people. And if that's the purpose, if that's an allowed purpose of the camera, when we're saying it's for accountability and to stop brutality and misconduct, then that is not a cost-benefit analysis I didn't want to buy into. That is, instead, it's going to put more people delay their lives and make it hard for them to do things and get jobs because more people are going to get prosecuted. And that's something that really needs to be talked about, and I don't see it being talked about in the study that you presented.
Okay. And I agree, we should continue those conversations. You know, this is just something I read last month, and it seemed to be a bigger study than it happened before, and it does raise two fundamental issues besides the cost, which may be a third one, but also, you know, the pretty big decline in complaints and fairly big decline in use of force. I'm not a scientist, as I said, I'm not a statistician, but these people from the University of Illinois, from what's the other university that was involved, New York University, and funded by a research grant from University of Chicago Crime Lab. Seems like you have a bunch of people here in academia that are saying that there's some benefit to it. And that's, I think, a discussion worth having. So that's kind of why I'm putting this out there, because at the end of the day, we're trying to make sure that the right thing gets done. I think, you know, whether it's police oversight with complaints against the police, or anything else, prosecution and so on, you know, how best to get that the right decision to be made. And I'm willing to like listen to the arguments on both sides about that. But I don't know, Mr. Hellman, 9.6% of, or what is it, 7% decrease, I believe, in use of force. 10% decrease. Yeah, 9.something% decrease in use of force. That would be hundreds per year in Portland, I think. So with use of force being a lot of different things, of course. So that's where I'm going with that being a benefit. Okay, anyways, this is just the very beginning. I'd like to kind of keep on having these conversations, and I think we'll bring in more people to have those conversations. And Mr. Handelman, I would love to continue these conversations offline with you as well, if you think that would be of any interest to you, just to kind of get a sense if there's any commonality here whatsoever. I value your opinion tremendously. You've been working in this area for a long, long time, and certainly much longer than I've been in Portland, even observing these things. So would value kind of having more discussions. But I do have some work that I need to get back to at 1 o'clock. So I got to run here. And if anybody needs anything, my email is out there, vadim.mazursky@portlandoregon.gov. Whether or not you'd like to discuss this or get some of the information that I've been discussing today, including the report, if you weren't able to pull down the link or anything. And Barb said that she's going to read the report and then talk about it. So we'll have other opportunities for that, and looking forward to talking about it.
And if we need other people to come to this meeting, just let me know and I'll arrange it.
Okay. Thank you, Irene.
Have a good evening, afternoon, everyone.
All right, everyone. Nice seeing everybody. Talk to you soon.